the red one. Deep sunk in musing, yet mightily uplifted, was the soul of Jacob in these days when he, with his brother Esau, buried their father. For all past events stood up in him and became present to his spirit, as they had once become present again in the flesh, according to the archetype. And to him it was as though the ground beneath his feet were transparent, consisting of crystal layers going down and down without any bottom, and lighted up by lamps which burned between the layers. But he walked above them, among the experiences of his proper flesh, Jacob, present in time, and gazed at Esau, who likewise walked again with him according to his archetype, and was Edom the Red. Such a characterization of Esau's personality is doubtless unobjectionable, yet doubtless in a certain sense, and unobjectionable only in a qualified one. For the clearness of it is like that of the moonlight, an illusory and deceptive clearness, in which we today can scarcely move with the bearing of pensive simplicity which characterized the persons of our story. I have related how Esau, the red-skinned, had, even in his youth and while still at Beersheba, established relations with the land of Edom, the people of the Goat Mountains and the wooded ranges of Seir. How he cultivated these relations, and later entirely identified himself with them. Went over root and branch with his Canaanitish wives, Aholibamah and Bashemoth, and their sons and daughters, to them and to their god, Cusach. The goat people, then, were already in existence, and had been for no one knows how long before Joseph's uncle Esau went over to them. And the tradition, later embodied in the chronicle and fabricated in the course of generations of fine language, which refers to him as the father of the Edomites and original goat of the goat people, is really nothing but moonshine. For Esau was not the father of Edom, not this Esau, but personally. However much he might be so considered in the story, and even, in a manner of speaking, by himself. The Edomites were in existence long before Joseph's uncle. I refer thus to Esau, because it is much safer to fix his identity in terms of the descending rather than of the ascending generations. They were immeasurably older than he, for that Bela, son of Beor, who is mentioned in the tables as the first king in Edom, is no more certainly the first king than Menes was certainly the first king of Egypt. And Menes's kingship is notoriously a case of time coulisse, so that our present Esau was certainly not the father of the Edomites in any exact sense. And when it was expressly sung of him, "He is Edom," but not, for instance, "He was Edom," the present tense is not a matter of chance, and the phrase is better understood as referring to a timeless and extra-personal generalization. Historically, and also individually, the original goat of the goat tribe was a remotely older Esau, in whose footsteps the present Esau trod, and it is well to add that the footsteps were right well-marked ones, and often trodden in. Probably, to put a point on it, they were not even the footsteps of him of whom the story might with justice assert that he was Edom. And here indeed our tale issues into mysteries, and our signposts are lost in the endlessness of the past, where every origin betrays itself as but an apparent halt and inconclusive goal, mysterious by its very nature, since that has to do not with distance, but with the sphere. For distance in a straight line has no mystery. The mystery is in the sphere. But the sphere consists in correspondence and redintegration. It is a doubled half that becomes one, that is made by joining an upper half and a lower half, a heavenly and an earthly hemisphere, which complement each other in a whole in such a manner that what is above is also below. And what happens in the earthly repeats itself in the heavenly sphere, and contrariwise. This complementary interchange of two halves, which together form a whole and a closed sphere, is equivalent to actual change, that is, to revolution. The sphere rolls. That lies in the nature of spheres. Bottom is soon top, and top bottom, insofar as one can speak of top and bottom in such a connection. Not only do the heavenly and the earthly recognize themselves in each other, but thanks to the revolution of the sphere, the heavenly can turn into the earthly into the heavenly, from which it is clear that gods can become men, and on the other hand, men can become gods again. All this is as true as it is true that Osiris, the dismembered martyr, was once a man, namely a king over Egypt, but became a god, though with a constant inclination to become a man again. Indeed, the phenomenon is plainly seen in the form of existence of all the Egyptian kings, all of them being god as man. But the question as to what Osiris was in the beginning, whether god or man, remains unanswered, since there is no beginning in the rolling sphere. The same is true of his brother Set, who, as I said some while back, was his murderer and dismembered him. This evil-doer was said to have an ass's head and to be of warlike mien, a huntsman to boot, who taught the kings of Egypt how to shoot with the bow, at Karnak near the Amun city. By others he was called Typhon, and he had early been assimilated to the burning desert wind, Khamsin, the burning sun, fire itself, and became Baal Hamon, or the god of fire, and was called among the Phoenicians Moloch, or Melech, the bull king of Baal, who with his fire consumes the children and the firstborn, and to whom Abram had been tempted to offer Isaac. What proof is there that Typhon Set, the red huntsman, was first and last at home in the skies, and none other than Nergal, the seven-named foe, Mars, the red, the fire planet? With equal right might it be asserted that he was in the beginning and at the end a man, Set, brother of Osiris the king, whom he thrust down from his throne and murdered, and that he only afterwards became a god and a planet, always prepared indeed to become a man again, according to the revolving of the sphere. He is both and neither first, planet god and man by turns in one. And therefore no time form is meet for him but the timeless present, which is resolved in the revolution of the sphere. And rightly is it always said of him, he is the red. But if Set the archer corresponds in the alternation of earth and heaven with Nergal Mars, the fiery planet, it is clear that the same relation exists between the murdered Osiris and the royal planet Marduk, to whom those black eyes looked up from the edge of the well, and whose god is called Jupiter Zeus. Of him is told that he cut off with a sickle the manhood of his father, Cronos, that giant deity who devoured his children, and would have done the same to Zeus but for the artfulness of his mother. Zeus deposed his father and made himself king in his place. This is a piece of information useful to those who, in the search for truth, are not minded to stop halfway. For it clearly means that Set, or Typhon, was not the first king-murderer, that Osiris himself had a murderer to thank for his throne, and that what he had done as Typhon was done to him as king. This, in other words, is part of the mystery of the sphere, that, thanks to the revolution, the unity and identity of the person may go hand in hand with a change of role. He is Typhon, so long as he is at the stage of plotting murder. After the deed, he is king, in the full majesty of success, and the role and character of Typhon fall to another. It has been thought by many that it was the red Typhon, and not Zeus, who cut off Cronus's manhood and dethroned him. But argument is idle, for what we are dealing with is only the same thing in revolution. Zeus is Typhon before he conquers. But the father-son relation revolves too. It is not always the son slaying the father, for at any moment the role of sacrifice may fall to the son, who then is slain by the father. In other words, Typhon Zeus by Cronos. The original Abram probably knew all this when he set out to sacrifice his only begotten son to Moloch the Red. Obviously he took the melancholy view that he must base himself on the story and carry out the tradition. God, however, prevented him. There was a time when Esau, Joseph's uncle, was constantly with his own uncle, Ishmael, Isaac's cast-off half-brother, visited him with surprising frequency in his wilderness underworld, and laid plots with him, the shocking nature of which we shall learn hereafter. The companionship was, of course, not due to chance, and if one speak of the Red One, one must also speak of Ishmael as well. His mother was named Hagar, the Wanderer, a name calculated to get her sent into the wilderness at once, that it might be fulfilled. But the immediate occasion of her expulsion was Ishmael, whose underworldly characteristics had always been much too prominent to make it likely that he could permanently retain the favor of the gods of the upper earth. It was written of him that he was a mocker, not in the sense of being loose-mouthed, that alone would not have disqualified him for the upper spheres. No, in his case, mocking is to be interpreted as sporting. Abram, having happened to see through the window Ishmael disporting himself in an underworldly manner with Isaac, his younger half-brother, which was by no means without its dangers for Yitzhak, the true-born son, Ishmael having a beauty like to the sunset on the desert plain. Therefore the future father of many sons was alarmed, and found the time was come for taking a decisive step. The relations between Sarah and Hagar had always been bad. Hagar had flaunted her maternity in the face of the barren woman, and once already had been obliged to flee before the jealous wrath of Sarah, who was constantly scheming to bring about the expulsion of the Egyptian and her offspring, not least because of the unsettled and contentious matter of the inheritance. Between the elder son of the concubine and the younger son of the true wife, the question arose whether Ishmael ought not to inherit jointly with Yitzhak, or even before him, a state of affairs intolerable to Sarah's jealous mother-love, and unpleasant likewise to Abraham. What he had seen brought down the scale. He presented the supercilious Hagar with her son, some bread and a bottle of water, and sent her away, never to return. What else could he have done? Should Yitzhak, the saved sin offering, fall victim after all to the fiery Typhon? Let me make the matter plain. It sounds most injurious to Ishmael, but was only fair, for the injuriousness lay in himself. That he walked in ways that were not quite every day, that he was himself not an everyday person, is undeniable. His very name sounds symbolic to us. Significant, too, is the fact that he became a very fine archer in the wilderness. It made an impression upon the wise men who have compared him with a wild ass, the beast Typhon Set, the murderer, the wicked brother of Osiris. Yes, he is the bad man. He is the red, and Abraham did well to drive him out, and to protect his favorite who had received the blessing from the snares of the fiery and the unrighteous. When Isaac begot sons of his wife's body, the red man came again to relive his history beside Jacob, the smooth man, the sweet-smelling grass and the prickly plant. Esau, the red-skinned, whom teachers and seers rail at more violently than his commonplace earthly person really merits. They call him serpent and Satan and swine as well, the wild pig, in allusion to the boar which tore in pieces the shepherd and lord in the glades of Lebanon. Yes, in their instructed anger, they call him a strange god, so that nobody can be deceived by his commonplace person as to what he actually is in the revolution of the sphere. It revolves, and often they are father and son, the unequal, the red man and the bearer of the blessing, and the son unmans the father, or the father slays the son. But often again, and nobody knows what they were at first, they are brothers, like Set and Osiris, Cain and Abel, Shem and Ham. And it may be that there are threes forming both pairs in the flesh, the father-son pair on the one hand, the brother pair on the other. For Ishmael, the wild ass, stands between Abram and Isaac. To one he is the son with the sickle, to the other the red brother. Did Ishmael then desire to unman Abram? Certainly he did, for he was in act to beguile Isaac into underworldly love. And if Isaac had not begotten upon his wife's body, Jacob had never been born, nor his 12 sons. And what then would have become of the promise of unnumbered seed, and of Abram's name, which signifies father of many? But now they moved again in the presentness of their own flesh, as Jacob and Esau. And even Esau, simpleton as he was, understood his own position. How much the more, then, Jacob, the instructed and pondering man? Of Isaac's blindness. The dim and blurring gaze of Jacob's wise brown eyes, with their somewhat weary expression, rested upon the huntsman, his twin, as the latter helped him to bury their father. And all the events of the past rose up again in him and became the brooding present. Their childhood, and how the long-awaited decision had at last been made, with the curse and the blessing and all that these involved. He mused, dry-eyed. Only now and again his breast heaved with the heaviness of his thoughts, and he gave an inward gasp. But Esau blubbered and howled throughout. Though all in all he had little for which to be grateful to the old man they were sewing up. For nothing, indeed, save the curse which was all that was left for him after the giving away of the blessing. To the father's sore grief, as Esau remained convinced. For it was a necessity to him, this conviction, and therefore he craved to hear it again and again, even out of his own mouth. 10 times while they worked, snuffling and wiping his nose, he said amidst wailings, "Thou, Yekef, wast beloved of the woman, but my father loved me, and ate with satisfaction of my venison. Hairy skin," said he, "my firstborn, it is savory to me, that which thou hast killed and prepared for my eating by the blazing fire. Yea, and I will eat of it, and thank thee for thy skill, and thou shalt remain my firstborn all thy days, and I will remember thee." Thus, and not otherwise, spake he 100 times and 1,000, but the woman loved thee, and spoke to thee, "Little Yekef, my chosen one," and the gods know that in the mother's love one lies softer than in the father's. So have I found it.